Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. This show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. This week we'll be hearing about prison organizing from the inside with members of the Free Alabama and Mississippi movements who are currently incarcerated. We'll also hear a few updates about situations as of Saturday, January 31st at Holman and St. Clair facilities in Alabama, both of which are under lockdown. But first, let's hear Sean Swain and then an update on Sean Swain's legal situation with Ben Turk.
I think the warning labels we see on consumer products today are the perfect analogy for what's wrong with the swivelization program. Warning labels represent the kind of faulty thinking at the very foundation of swivelization. Consider, to be swivelized, as opposed to being savage, boils down to food acquisition. That's really what distinguishes one from the other. Swivelized people mass-produce food through farming, while savages hunt and gather. Where swivelized mass-producing farmers encounter savage hunter-gatherers, the swivelized thing to do is to exterminate the savages and steal their land to grow crops. That's led to a global human population of 7 billion swivelized people. 7 billion mouths to feed, provoking the slash and burn of enough acreage to grow food to stuff in 7 billion mouths. And that means pushing lots of other species out of existence. But that also leads to 7 billion bowel bags f***ing up the planet. What comes in goes out. So we've engineered a complex centralized management system to get toilet paper and batteries, burgers and tampons where they need to go. In the process, we've toxified our air, our land, and our water. Those are the prices we pay for maintaining 7 billion of us at the expense of other species and at the expense of the land base that sustains us. But that's the swivelization program. Ensure survival for the maximum number of humans at any cost. And that faulty thinking is also the rationale for the warning labels on everything. Swivelization didn't just domesticate our food. It domesticated us. We are to the wild savage what the slope-shouldered, dull-eyed cow is to the wild, majestic bison. And warning labels protect our slope-shouldered and dull-eyed specimens from their own idiot impulses. We have warning labels on coffee because it's hot. We have warning labels with stick figure diagrams on hair dryers so you won't use them in the shower. Where I grew up in Michigan, after a drunken kid dove into a fountain with 2 feet of water and broke his neck, they erected a 10-foot chain-link fence around the fountain with no diving signs. I swear I'm not making that up. Warning labels preserve the lives of fountain divers and hot coffee guzzlers who, if left to their own devices, would quickly take themselves out in imaginative and amusing fashion. Warning labels, like the larger swivelization program itself, exempts idiots from natural selection. As a consequence, we now have a proliferation of fountain divers and shower zappers kept in commission through unnatural interferences, so that every cross-eyed reject come off the assembly line of this swivelization idiot factory reaches puberty and then splashes around in the shallow end of the gene pool, spawning a generation even more devolved. Soon, he may have to put do not lick signs over electrical sockets. NASA will have to figure out how to stencil do not stare on the surface of the sun. We pursue this trajectory to our own peril. Imagine if we had never swivelized but had hunted and foraged for the last 6,000 years. We'd have a population of roughly 200 million. Subject to natural selection, this limited population would permit a variety of life to thrive. Doing the math, swivelization's idiot factory has produced roughly 6.8 billion socket lickers and sun gazers, who otherwise wouldn't have shown up, turning the planet into a toxic cesspool of plastic bottles and disposable diapers. These socket lickers are so ubiquitous, it's now inevitable that sooner or later they'll swerve into our lanes of traffic and wipe us out. Congratulations. The guy who didn't electrocute himself with his hairdryer just took out a family of six. I say shut down the idiot factory right now and let the chips fall where they may, even if I'm one of the 6.8 billion sun gazers who will soon be converted into mulch. To those who think my position is heartless and cruel, consider the ultimatum our current reality dictates to us. we can save the planet and kill civilization, which would save roughly 200 million of us to carry on our species into the next Neolithic, or we can save civilization and kill the planet, which results in the death of everything. We'll all sputter out together, taking everything with us down the proverbial toilet of omnicidal oblivion. Unfortunately, socket lickers of the delusional hierarch variety make up the vast majority, and if we continue to defer to them, we'll all go down together. Our only hope is to tear down the idiot factory, to topple civilization in its entirety, without seeking mass approval. Death to civilization. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville hyphen Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
We are on the line with the infamous Ben Turk, lesbian, rabble-rouser, prisoner's advocate, anarchist. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, what's up with Sean? How's he doing? What news do you have?
He's mostly doing well. He just issued his executive orders abolishing the state of Ohio, and so he's kind of happy to be the governor in exile of Ohio right now, and he's talking about further political ambitions. But he's also getting screwed over by the weasels as usual.
What exactly are the bleep weasels doing to him?
So we had scheduled a handful of video visits, because I'm out in Colorado now and I wanted to be able to visit him through the magic of internet and JPay, the same company that took over inmate billing accounts and has inmate emails and all the rest of that stuff, private corporation that makes lots of money off of controlling the communication of prisoners, which also benefits the state because it's easier for the state to monitor that communication because it's all keyword searchable emails and stuff. So, anyway, somebody at OSP or at the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections decided that we should not be allowed to have that visit for some reason that is not explained, and they just canceled it.
That's rather random.
Yeah, I don't know. They probably thought that maybe we were going to, put those videos out in public somewhere, probably because that's what we were going to do. But we are legally allowed to do that. There is no regulation saying that you can't. The ODRC does have a media policy, but I'm not media. I just have a website and a Facebook account. And if that makes somebody media, then most visitors for prisoners in Ohio are also media. So clearly this is actually just about targeting Sean and preventing him from exercising his free speech.
So what's Sean doing about it?
So Sean, in the, immediate angry response, went to the JPay kiosk and sent JPay an email saying he was going to start refusing food on Monday, and then calmed down a little bit and thought a little bit more about hunger strikes and whether or not that's the kind of action he wants to do, but he's already made that threat and he can't make empty threats. So he is going to be refusing food starting on Monday.
If he's actually officially claiming that he's refusing food, like, if it's an official hunger strike, what does that mean in terms of how the his warders deal with him?
Yeah, so after he refuses three meals, then they will count him as officially on hunger strike, and they will transfer him to a separate part of the prison so that other prisoners can't feed him, sneak him food, and then they'll take him away from his property and things like that. So it does have, in addition to him going without food, it's going to mess with his life somewhat. But he's, responding and pushing back whenever they come after him and do something to him, he responds in whatever way he can. Even though he doesn't believe in hunger strikes, and I kind of disagree with him on this. I feel like if you're in lockdown at OSP, then hunger strikes is kind of the only option that you have. And just because it's reformist and because it's demanding things from people with power doesn't mean that it's necessarily illegitimate. And it has worked for other prisoners in the past. The guys I work with from the Lucasville Uprising, every time that they've gone on a hunger strike and increased their privileges, it has allowed them greater communication with each other and with the outside world, which has allowed them to more effectively organize for larger goals, you know?
What are folks doing on the outside to support him to get his...
Well, we're also, his lawyer is going to be contacting people and possibly adding if J-Pay is complicit in this in some way beyond just, like, doing what they told, possibly adding them to the lawsuit that we have pending against 11 different officials with the Ohio prison system. And we're also going to be calling in. So if anybody else wants to call in, we're assuming that this canceling of these visits originates with Trainwreck Trevor Clark, the lead counsel at ODRC Legal Services. He has been a thorn in Sean's side for the last few years. And so we're going to be calling his boss, Stephen Gray. His number is 614-752-1765. And just asking why these visits were canceled, why Sean's access to communication is being messed with again, and if Trevor Clark is behind it.
There's another element that Sean was concerned about that came up. In as far as isn't there like a contractual obligation to allow access to prisoners throughout the prison to their J-Pay kiosk twice a day? And I heard that there were some changes that happened with that.
Yeah, so Sean called me about, so I got emails late last night saying that these video visits were canceled, and I was like, I wonder what that is, and I was gonna, you know, just be available. He called me this morning and said that they were canceled, and he thought that maybe I had canceled them, and when I clarified that I hadn't, he then wrote up some things that he's going to send to me, and he told me that he'd be sending them in the afternoon, because he gets to the email kiosk twice a day. But then at count, it was announced that they were not going to get the usual second visit that day, and that the policy had just shifted conveniently at that moment, and so now none of the prisoners at OSP on level 4B, which is the level he's on, they're all going to only get access to the kiosk once a day instead of twice a day.
So, and even though they're not necessarily addressing this as specific to his case, it seems like the timing would point to it being, so it's like kind of a form of like mass punishment, right?
Yeah, it's awfully coincidental, and it's probably mass punishment, and it's probably trying to isolate him from other prisoners, or make other prisoners mad at him because they're losing access to their families, and it is, you know, his fault, according to them. But most of the prisoners, it seems, are smart enough to recognize that it's the prison's fault and not blaming him. And so instead they're having their families call in and harass the prison for making that change.
Seems like it might be potentially illegal if it's breaking contract with J-Pay, right?
Right, yeah, you would think. I'm not familiar with the intricacies of the J-Pay contract, but I would assume that Sean is, and that he's right on that. So, a lot going on. There's also a recent update on seanswain.org about the civil lawsuit that Sean is working on that I mentioned earlier. So there's lots of information and lots of constant pressure through every diverse tactics channel that he can gain access to.
Well, we've been speaking with the indefatigable center. Is that right? Indefatigable? Indefatigable.
I don't know, it looks better on paper than it sounds coming out of my mouth.
Yeah, I think I heard a Monty Python song once that pronounced it indefatigable.
Okay.
Finberg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We apologize for the low quality of recording, but our guests are in prison and we had a poor connection. We should have a transcript up with the show blog soon. Melvin Ray is a podcast host, author, activist, member of the Free Alabama Movement, and is currently incarcerated at St. Clair Correctional Facility in Springville, Alabama. Can the other gentleman on the line introduce himself?
Yes, my name is Kinetic, as in Kinetic Energy. That's Damon. I'm the co-founder of the Free Alabama Movement. Currently, in maximum security, locked up at Holman Correctional Facility in Atmore, Alabama.
Thank you both for coming on, and my understanding is in a few minutes we'll be joined by a comrade from the Free Mississippi Movement. But I guess in the meantime, if y'all would talk about the current situations at your prisons. I know St. Clair has been on lockdown recently, and in St. Clair, Mr. Ray, if you could talk a little bit about what has changed since Carter Davenport has become warden there and what the current situation is.
Okay, St. Clair is one of the three maximum security prisons in the state of Alabama. We got a population around 1,300 men here. So we have this warden here, Carter Davenport, and I would say over the last 36 months, we've had probably five or six murders at this prison, and that rate for a prison this small, they did a study, and they said that that would make this probably one of the second, third, most dangerous prisons in the country. And so we've been dealing with that over several years now. And St. Clair, it has been a very violent prison, and we had been able to get that violence under control under a prior administration. They allowed us to have different programs, education. We had a mentoring and tutoring program. We had gang intervention, mediation and conflict resolution. And when we had those programs, the last year that we had the program, it was founded by a man named Earl Taylor. We called him Tyree. And he was a longtime gang member. He was an influential leader in the prison system. And he started this organization to bring these entities together to stop the violence. And we had actually taken the violence level down to where there were 23 violent incidents in 2010, which was the year prior to Carter Davenport coming over. And in 3 years later, 2013, the violence had quadrupled. There was over 100 violent incidents in just 2013, and it continued to escalate until the killing started. And so we had a killing in 2012, we had another killing in 2013, then we had four murders in 2014 last year. And all of that can be directly traced back to when Carter Davenport got here. He stopped the Convicts Against Violence program. He had never been at a maximum security prison like this, and he brought a lot of ideas with him from some of the institutions that he came from, and they don't work in these types of environments. And so he took that program, and immediately after that, taking the program, he took all of the books out of the block, CDs and stuff like that. And so he created a void where the guys who we had been, you know, cultivating relationships and building bridges and building guys up, he took that void away. And so we didn't have a way to address what he had taken back, and it has been replaced with violence ever since. And even starting off the year 2015, the prison's been on lockdown twice. We've had over 20 stabbings already. A few of them were very, very serious. A couple of people, you know, were just in the inch of losing their life. And so that's what we're dealing with right now. We're dealing with a wave of violence. You know, officers are beating guys. We had a guy got beat yesterday. They got some little cages where they are taking guys to beating them. And, you know, that's what we're dealing with right now at St. Clair facility.
I think I had read somewhere that the warden himself had been known to have beaten a convict while he was handcuffed.
That's right. He beat a guy. He had a guy. He had took a guy. He was handcuffed, and the guy was saying some things to him, you know, but it was just words, and he was saying words to him. The warden didn't like it, so he just took and punched him in the back of the head, and that's the warden that runs the prison. That's and the warden under him, his name is Warden Evans, and he's assaulted three people. He's actually got it in his jacket where he's beaten, you know, two or three people. He's stolen property from people and got caught lying and got suspended for. So it's just a culture here that we see where there's no accountability from the top. And when, you know, subordinates see the warden beating a person, then how can that warden hold his subordinates responsible when they beat another man? And how can they look to him and be like, you know, so that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a culture of violence that, you know, starts at the very top.
Yes, and I'm currently being housed at Holman Correctional Facility.
Okay.
Which is in the southern region of Alabama, where the Delta is. cleared out at.
Kinetic House, is there any sort of lockdown situation at your facility also? I'd heard that there were a few facilities in Alabama that were all being, like, in that same scenario of being in lockdown right now.
Yes, there are certain portions of Holman that are still currently are locked up, but over the last 8 days, the general population has been locked down twice due to a violent incident, and in reference to there being a lack of officers due to death row being on the current protest. As we speak now, they're on their seventh day of a work stoppage or non-compliance or non-violent peaceful protest on death row, dealing with issues of sanitary living conditions and recreational opportunities and so forth. So the prison has been locked down twice in the last 7 to 8 days. But the current situation at Holman, as I said, this is where they house death row inmates and where they carry out the death penalty. And that is an issue that is always newsworthy of the things that are going on there. But Holman in general is the epitome of warehousing individuals in order to have a free labor workforce. This is the epitome of mass incarceration and prison slavery. There are no educational programs in this facility. Roughly probably 60% of the people here have life sentences or life without parole. And that is exactly the mentality that this administration fosters. And there are no religious programs that are sanctioned by the administration to the extent where you can be educated and rehabilitated and prepared to go back to society. They have what's called a GED program where inmates tutor one another, and the grant money continues to go to the state, yet none of the benefits of having a GED are afforded these brothers. As I said, it's a free labor workforce, as inmates do all of the work in this institution. What's most noteworthy about this institution is that it houses the tag plant, and the tag plant produces every tag that is made in the state of Alabama, whether it's for a motorcycle, RV, car, et cetera. And these brothers who are being forced to work in this this tag plant are being paid 15 to 25 cents an hour to produce 100,000 tags per week. And, you know, like I said, Holman is just the epitome of warehousing a free labor workforce with no goal or no intention of educating, rehabilitating, or preparing any of these men to be reintegrated into society to become productive citizens. So there are many occasions in the segregation unit where I'm at now, there's been a lot of hostility as we are not afforded sanitary eating utensils. We're not afforded spoons and cups. Some brothers are forced to eat with the same spoon for 7 or 8 months before they stumble up on a new one. And if you don't have a cup, you're forced to drink out of an empty milk cart. And, you know, that has caused a lot of unrest inside of the segregation unit, and there have been several incidents where brothers have been sprayed with mace and left in cells for hours without getting medical attention. And any kind of infraction upon the administration in regards to these brothers speaking out about being sprayed, they're being placed on sack lunches. And that is 2 cheese sandwiches 3 times a day. And they're using the food as a means to control the behavior of the people in order to deal with legitimate issues that are being raised in regards to unsanitary food serving practices, as well as the lack of cleaning supplies in order to clean the area that you live in. So we're dealing with a lot of issues that fall into the unsanitary living conditions and the inhumane treatment that the Free Alabama Movement has been promoting and advocating since January the 1st, 2014, when we began the work stoppage here at Holman, which spread to St. Clair and Elmore Correctional Facility, as well as to a few other smaller institutions.
One of the ways that people on the outside might be aware of y'all's activities and organizing is through the YouTube videos that were released a few years ago. Can you talk about those? What sort of repercussions there were from the prison staff, and also, like, what the foundational philosophy underneath the Free Alabama Movement is?
Just to the video, we'll speak to those first. And we're also joined by a brother from the Free Mississippi Movement also, so I just wanted to let you know that we'll. But the videos, what we did was, we deal with the media the same way other mainstream media outlets do. When something goes on inside of a prison, the only people who are allowed to talk to the media are state officials, state corrections facilities. And we know that when these people talk to the media, that they're going to put the message in their best interest, in their best light. And so what we did with the videos was we had to sit down and create our own message, because a lot of guys went to trial and didn't testify at trial. And a lot of guys have spent time, you know, decades in prison, and they've never been heard from. No media is allowed inside Alabama prison system. And so the first goal and priority with the videos was to give the people a voice, to give an opportunity of expression, because you got in Alabama, you can go up for parole and you'll never see the parole board. They'll never talk to you. They just look at a file, look at what you did 20 years ago, and make a decision on whether or not you're going to be granted parole. And we felt like that was very unfair and that guys deserve an opportunity to be heard from ourselves. And so we sat down with these videos to rehumanize people, because we're force fed a concept where these are criminals, these are the worst that life has to offer. And we know that that's not true, but we didn't have a way to counteract that. And so we sat down with the video. And then we followed that up by saying that we are going to protest these conditions. And a lot of times when men on the inside of prisons do protest, the first thing that the administration does is they go in and say, well, this is a riot. And they justify their actions, and they'll go in and brutalize them. And so we got out in front of them because we knew their game plan and their scheme. And we filmed these, the living conditions. We went inside the kitchen, and you literally see rats just running around in the kitchen, inside the living areas, rats, roaches, bugs, mold, mildew. And we just exposed people to the reality of what prisons are like and the moral decay of what a prison is like, as opposed to what they try to tell us that the people are like. They paint a concept that the people in prison are the ones who are the vicious, the vile, the scourge of the earth. But the reality is it's the institutions that they put us in, and add into that mix the conditions that we come into these prisons in that create these type of, you know, images that they try to portray. And so we wanted to counteract that and show that there are guys on the inside who are working to overcome a lot of the things. And so that's what the videos pretty much were about, to get that message out there. As far as the underpinnings of the movement itself, Free Alabama Movement, Free Mississippi Movement, Free California Movement, what we're doing is we're evaluating this system that we're in. And we're defining it in the terms that the facts provide for us. And these are slave plantations. You know, when we use the word slavery, we've heard a lot of people say, well, y'all shouldn't call it slavery. Well, they don't know what it's like. You know, if you come inside of a prison, okay, the cell that I'm in right now, there's no table for me to sit down and eat my food on. There's no table for me to sit down and read a book. I'm in a cell where my toilet, I can literally sit on my toilet. But this is the toilet where I have to defecate at. This is the same place I have to urinate at. And this is the same place where I have to wash my face and brush my teeth. But this is also the same place that I have to eat my food at. You know, and so when I get off of the toilet, I'm trapped inside of a cell. There's no ventilation. There's no fresh air. And then I go over here on the bed, and it's a 2-foot concrete slab. And I have a 4-inch dog mattress that they make me sleep on. And I've been sleeping on this. You know, we sleep on this for the duration of our confinement. And then the food comes through the tray hole, and we got videos of the food up on the YouTube, as you mentioned. And this is something that people wouldn't feed their dog. You know, we got plenty of pictures and, you know, raw food, uncooked food, because guys who work in these kitchens in prisons, especially on the state level, they're not certified. They don't have any training. They haven't, you know, they don't know how to prepare food, preserve food, cook food. They're in there because they're being punished. Okay, you talking back to me? You go and work in the kitchen. Okay, you don't want to clean the cell up? Okay, you go into. And they use that as a punishment, but this is a vital, vital part of our ability to stay alive. And this food that they're coming out is just beyond anything that people can understand. And we have no right. They beat us, and then they charge us with assault. Everything that we get is at their discretion. And so that's what the institution of slavery was all about. And we're here until they say we can leave. you know, we've been separated from our families. True enough, some people have committed crimes, but a lot of people are mentally ill. A lot of people are innocent. And then you have other people who are guilty, but they are rehabilitated, and they are continuing to be punished. And so we're trying to address all of those issues. But what we found out was is that the reason why everyone is here is because they monetize these systems. They turn them into pure businesses. This is not about crime in any sense of the word. You know, this is about capitalism. There are some people here because they committed crimes, but that's not what these facilities are for throughout the country today. It's about making money off of. They charge us for medical copay. They charge us for armbands. They charge us for IDs. They charge us for phone calls. They charge us for, you know, jacked up prices at the canteen. And then we have to pay, you know, court costs and fines and fees. If my mother sends me $50 before I get it, if I got sick, then I got to pay whatever the state say I owe them, and I'll get what's left, you know. And then on top of all of that, in the morning, I got to get up and go to work for free, and I'm going to be producing products that will be sold on the open market for full retail value, and I won't get a penny for it. But they'll steadily be charging me for anything and everything that I receive. And so we're saying, how are you charging us all these fines, fees, and services, and you know that we're working for free? And so when we start adding these numbers up, it's into the billions and billions and hundreds of billions of dollars. And so when we realize that, and we realize that the labor was the centerpiece of everything that we're doing, we started organizing that labor so that we can get a voice in what's going on, you know, as opposed to the people who are passing these laws to make money off of us while we're here.
This is The Final Straw with Bursa Goodness, and we're speaking with three members of the Free Alabama and Mississippi Movement, incarcerated in those states and working towards a mass movement against incarceration and inhumane conditions. More at freealabamamovement.com. Again, we apologize for the low quality of recording, but our guests are in prison and we had a poor connection. We should have a transcript up of this show on the blog soon. The person from the Free Mississippi Movement, could you introduce yourself and where you're at?
Yes, I'm currently housed in Mississippi, and I'm a part of the MDOC operation, which is the Mississippi Department of Correction, or should I say corruption. And I would like to add to the same understanding that we actually, you know, bear witness to these effects that the Free Alabama Movement is emphasizing, and, you know, all these different issues are valid and warrant, you know, some type of relief or justification, you know, and we realize that, you know, the government aspects of prison is not for our rehabilitation. This has been an ongoing cycle. I know here in Mississippi, we have gained acknowledgement and exposure of the Mississippi Department of Correction Commissioner, which, you know, have been indicted under 49 count indictment of many bribery schemes and other misuse of trust dealing with the institution and how it's been operating and how it has allowed private owned business to come into the play of Mississippi, you know, for selfish and personal motive due to many kickback schemes that they have been benefiting the wages off of commissary and other constructions like medical assistance and other constructions like the food service providers or whatever, which, you know, it also have been exposed that the food service providers here in Mississippi have been buying food from areas of other countries and other companies that wasn't even FDIC approved, whatever. It wasn't even qualified for human, you know, human rights. It was more for animal food, animal feeding, or whatever. So, you know, all this was actually done under the small wages that they was actually utilizing, you know, for the caretaking of our condition, you know, throughout the MDOC facility or operations. And this has been an ongoing cycle, and we also exposed a lot of corruption throughout the governmental system here in Mississippi, because with those same issues in mind and with those same issues on the table, you know, we're dealing with a lot of people that have been incarcerated among the MDOC due to the judicial system of Attorney General's office, as well as the medical field office or whatever, that have allowed a guy by the name of Steve Haynes to come into their existence here in Mississippi for over 20 years. And you saw about the indication of being a autopsy reporter or a forensic doctor or whatever, And somehow, you know, this have became exposed in the last 7-8 years, you know, nationally, and they yet to correct it. You know, overall, you know, you have thousands of people now incarcerated and thousands that have been in and out, you know what I'm saying, in the last 20 years of this bogus forensic doctor, Stephen Haynes, who the state, you know, used for the purpose of undermining jurors and doing other detailed reports to their style, to their advantage. This same doctor was being used for a lot of prison or jailhouse murders that officers and guards had been actually committing crimes against, you know, inmates or offenders or whatever, and they used this same doctor as an escape route, you know, to cover their actions. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why they yet to correct this error, because, you know, this will fall back on a whole lot of the government officials throughout Mississippi region. And right now, you know, we actually, you know, trying to, you know, campaign up on these levels of gang anymore, as the brother was just stating, it's already clear that, you know, the institution is out of balance, you know, and is under many circumstances of inadequate medical treatment, inhumane conditions, the prison overcrowding, the lack of rehabilitation, you know, and the exploitation, you know, of these various networks that they have set up among. We have several people that have died throughout the institution due to these same network operations of lack of medical attention or lack of a lot of rehabilitation levels. If you have certain illness or whatever, you know, you doesn't have a doctor on duty, you know, you may have to wait 3 days, if not more, a week before you can actually, you know, see a doctor or report your issue to a doctor. So, you know, that inclines a person to more defects in health value, no proper and adequate assistance. No, we can't just blame the institution for doing what it does. No, we also have to blame the governor for allowing the state to operate like that. So we really trying to put these matters in the right people's hands, you know, so that the right people will help us gain the right result. And as the brother said, from the institution aspect, you know, they gonna always cover their actions or try to justify their means to keep their system operating and appearing to be clean. But if you actually go into the roots of these issues and errors, then you know that, you know, this is all a scheme. A scheme to, you know, counteract their own defect. They actually, you know, try to make the ten or make seem as though, you know, this system is operating by the integrity or the dignity and the peace and qualities of the state or the United States itself. With, you know, these issues is real. They actually violent, you know, and they actually lead the right results, the right resolutions for rehabilitation over mass incarceration.
How has the 13th Amendment, but its allowance for people to still be incarcerated if they're quote-unquote duly convicted of a crime, right, led to this privatized capitalist prison system?
Okay, we'll let Brother Kinetic speak on that, because he just did writing on that, and he started with the Civil War. So Brother Kinetic, he can speak to that.
Yeah, that is a good issue that we do need to bring attention to, because a lot of people in this country actually believe that slavery was abolished and that America put its ugly past of chattel slavery behind it for good with the Civil War. But a lot of people don't really study and understand the history that the Civil War was really a war of economical systems, economical advantages between the planters in the South and the industrialists in the North. A lot of people think that the North won the war. But when we look at the 13th Amendment, all it did was modify and codify the institution of slavery. As it says, slavery is abolished except unless a person has been duly convicted. We have studied history from the book that Mr. Blackman wrote with Slavery by Another Name, and he lays out how most Southern states immediately began enacting different laws and different codes to criminalize the lifestyle of black people in America, and eventually turned the prison system into a convict leasing system, which modified itself. And today, we've seen it morph into a multi-billion dollar industry where the exact same parallels are being made, where there are people who have been chained and bound for some reason by the mass majority of those who are in power. Whether it be the color of your skin or for some kind of offense that they say that you made, you've been confined and chained. And once you're chained and confined, you've been living in poor quality. The quality of living is extremely poor for the slaves, just as it is today in the prison system. Slaves were forced to work for free while the masters benefited from all of their labor and all of their work. The same equivalent today in the prison system throughout this country, that more people than not are forced for fear of being beat up, fear of being rolled up, or fear of being locked up to work for free throughout these prison systems. And all the benefits of that labor return to the state, and the actual person who provides the labor receives no benefit of it. As in order to live inside of these institutions, these brothers are forced to have to lean on their family, friends, and loved ones for financial support. And even when you do that, the state has set a marker to get a percentage of what you buy to your book. They get a percentage of what you mail to your book. But for the most part, they're working in the kitchens, they're working on the halls, the cleanup crews, the factories, the industries, and so forth. These are all jobs that continue to keep this prison system functioning and moving, yet the people who provide that labor receive none of the benefits, and we work for free. And that is by law that we are prohibited from earning money. So it is a part of the 13th Amendment that has set the platform for these states to enact whatever laws they want in order to re-enslave a portion of the population in order to provide the labor necessary to keep these systems and these machines running. And the parallels are I think, exceptionally clear when we studied the pathway that most slaves were brought on a ship to this country, just like most people who are in prison are brought to the receiving center on these vans. Once the slave was brought to America, he was shaved and sprayed for whatever kind of disease or illness they thought he had. The same thing goes on in these receiving centers. They cut all your hair and spray you with insecticide. You were put on a platform and somebody bought you and they tell you what plantation you were going to. The same thing happens in these receiving centers. At the receiving center, you're evaluated and they determine what plantation you're going to be sent to, and it's called a prison camp. And rather than having an overseer and a slave out there, they have wardens and deputy wardens. But it's the same exact system. They change the name, but never change anything about the condition of the situation or the people who are being oppressed in these economical systems.
It was mentioned earlier a lack of educational opportunities, and there's the assumption, as the gentleman being held by MDOC from the Free Mississippi Movement brought up, there's no educational opportunities, and there's a lot of recidivism. Can someone draw the connection between those two things?
When you, I'll just use Alabama as an example. And these numbers pretty much are consistent around the country. 80% of all people who enter Alabama Department of Corrections are functionally illiterate. And so when you have this large-scale illiteracy, then they have numbers that show that 75% of African-American men who drop out of high school end up in prison. So we can trace the education and the poverty of incarceration directly. And so when you incarcerate a person, then you're looking at factors and say, okay, the reason why this person is involved in crime is because he's uneducated and because he doesn't have a skill set that will allow him to function, social development that will allow him to function in society. And so the thing you would, any rational, normal person would say is, okay, the first thing we need to do is to get this guy his basic education. Where did he fail at? Did he stop in the ninth grade, eighth grade, and start there and get him up to a GED or high school diploma? Okay, they don't do that in the prison system. It's not mandatory, and a lot of prisons don't even provide even a GED program. And so when you see that, you immediately have to have a question, okay, how is it that you can have a person who is functionally illiterate, who doesn't have a skill to trade, and he doesn't have social development skills to make it in society, and you brought him out of society into a system of correction? And that's what they're supposed to be correcting, the deficiencies in the person. And instead of correcting them, they're saying, this is your job assignment. You work for this corporation. You make these T-shirts. You make these night vision goggles. And then they turn around and invest money into criminal justice programs in colleges and get people to think and to buy into their concept that labor is a permissible form of rehabilitation, making them work. And they sell it to the public that working is okay. But in the broader scheme of things, the labor is the only thing that people are here for. And so what we are fighting for in Free Alabama, Mississippi movement, Free California movement, is for education, rehabilitation, and reentry preparedness. We're saying we're no longer willing to be slaves. We're standing up and demanding our freedom. And our freedom starts with removing these walls, but our liberation actually starts with our education and rehabilitation and reentry preparedness. So, I mean, I'll give you an example. I have three mail rejection notices that I've received, and each one of them say, the part of the prison that you're in, you're not allowed to receive books. So I wasn't allowed to receive books, newspapers, magazines, education material, anything. The only two books I have an option on is either a Bible or a Quran. And that's the same thing that went on the slave plantation. Education was illegal, but you could have a Bible. The societies have merged and Islam has made it to the West and whatnot. Now you can get a Quran, but that's it. You know, and so there's no pretense about what's going on. And now there is not, we no longer have a lack of understanding. We know what's going on now with these systems. So education, rehabilitation are words that are just thrown around that have no real meaning inside these institutions. And that's what our job is to give meaning to those words. Again,
it was mentioned in a statement about the unrest at some of the facilities in Alabama, about the recent U.S. Department of Justice investigation around Tutwiler's prison for women and the long history of assault and rape by guards there. Can one of you talk about that, and also about how the Free Alabama and Mississippi and California movements have been bridging the gender gap between facilities?
Okay. First, with the Free California movement, we just now organizing with those brothers, so they're sisters, brothers and sisters out there. So that's in the infant developmental stages. Alabama and Mississippi, we do have male and female prisons. And specifically, we have Julia Tutwiler prison. And at Tutwiler prison, we found out in the 1st of January that there had been a lot of women who had been writing the Justice Department complaining about conditions that were going on there. And the Department of Justice went in and did investigations for about a year. And they did their investigations in 2013, and they completed their report on January the 14th or 17th of 2014. And this report found that there is a culture of violations of these women's civil and human rights. This is the way the prison operates. And coincidentally, Warden Davenport, the warden who's the warden over St. Clair, he was at Tutwiler prison, and we've had women come on who served time at Tutwiler talk about the sexual misconduct that Warden Davenport displayed against them personally. And so what we found out is that over a 20-year period, these women had been raped, they had been abused, they had been forced into sex. They would say that they were not being provided enough, you know, the hygiene and whatnot that women need. And when they need their pads or when they need stuff like that, that when they would go and ask for them, that the officer would tell them to, you know, turn around and show them their ass or show them their breath. And they would have to suffer all these indignities just for the basic necessities. And so we found, we were able to get in contact with them, and we learned that some of these women were, after they would be raped, some of them who would get pregnant would be forced to have the child. Other ones who would get pregnant would be forced to have an abortion. We learned that they had a secret abortion house. And you remember, the state, state and federal taxpayer dollars were being used to fund these abortions. Federal taxpayer dollars were being used to fund these pregnancies. And none of this money was allocated for that. But all of this was allowed to go on, and that tells us that these facts were known on a broad scale. When a woman has been incarcerated for 7 years and she's in a maximum security prison and she comes up pregnant, there is no question about what has happened. And so you have levels of silence that are going on through, you know, there's no telling how many layers of the government that was aware of this until it became a part of just simply that's the way that things go. And that's what we ended up finding out. And we found out that even when the people were reported, that at the time, only 6 officers had been prosecuted, and one of them had been prosecuted for rape. He got 6 months, and one person, he sexual his from his misconduct, he ended up with 5 days out of these 6 people who were prosecuted. And so, you know, and these women are still terrified. They're still afraid. And we've been fighting to get media into them. Part of the major component of our platform, Free Alabama Mississippi Movement, is what we call our freedom bill. And in these freedom bills, we lay out a curriculum on what we're demanding that prisons be changed to, or we're going to stop these factors from running. We're going to stop this money from coming in. And we're going to see what they can do without us, because it's too much money being made for us to be in the conditions that we're in, whether it's the living conditions, the sentencing, the lack of due process, the parole, no real opportunities for parole, filing post-conviction petitions for wrongful convictions, and the courts are all on the same page that no one's going to be released. And so when we look at these women and we look at their situation, so they're dealing with all of the issues of mass incarceration, and then they're dealing with the same issues that took place on these plantations where women were considered property. And those women have been considered property of those state officers, and they've been using them, you know, in any way that they can. We've had a protest at the prison. We're going to have more protests at the prison, and we're going to continue to reach out to those women because they're very much a part of mass incarceration and all the issues that the rest of us are being subjected to.
You do a radio show on a regular basis, and that's pretty amazing. How does that work, and does it reach other folks on the inside, or is it mostly for reaching folks outside of prison walls?
We have a Blog Talk Radio show that is titled The People's Platform, and The People's Platform is an open and honest dialogue between brothers and sisters that are incarcerated and our family, friends, and loved ones and supporters in the community. As for those people who are interested in learning more about mass incarceration, prison, slavery, some firsthand accounts, our audience is made up of different brothers and sisters that are incarcerated throughout the states of Alabama, Mississippi, California, Virginia, and a lot of other states. And our show offers each person an opportunity to voice their concerns, their comments, and their questions, but it more so enlightens the people in society about the things that are actually going on inside of these institutions. There's an opportunity for people in society to extend their assistance to us. So it has worked out beautifully as a network and a platform for the brothers and sisters incarcerated with the people on the outside. And the movement has received great benefit from programs such as this.
I want to add something.
Definitely.
I know we're getting close up against the time. We're organizing prison work strikes in Alabama, in Mississippi, California, but we're trying to get these work strikes to catch on around the country. The second thing that we're doing, when we bring our family members, friends, and loved ones in, we're calling for a new strategic approach to mass incarceration. We're calling for everyone to make prisons ground zero in the fight. We don't want people marching on the Capitol. We don't want people marching in the park. We want all of our people at a prison in your state. We're going to have one prison that'll serve as the headquarters in each state, and that's where we'll ask everyone to go to. The other prisons, we're asking family members, when you go to visit your loved one, to spread the word at those prisons about what's going on, about these movements, and then let them know that when they have demonstrations, they'll be having them at these prisons. We've already demonstrated at 2 prisons in the state of Alabama, and we're going to expand that this year. By the time the year is over, we'll be demonstrating at 5 different prisons in Alabama. Mississippi is about to start their demonstrations at their prisons. And so we're doing that. And the other part of our strategy is we're targeting corporations that are benefiting from prison labor. There's too many of them for us to get caught up in a scattergun approach. So what we've done is we've narrowed it down to a major company, a major corporation that profits off of prison slavery, and we're fixing to start dumping flyers and leaflets in their parking lot. We're fixing to start writing their corporate partners and business partners. We're fixing to start notifying the media, and we're going to start having protests at their storefront. And the first company that we're going to start off with is McDonald's, and we're going to ask people all around the country. You don't have to come to Alabama or Mississippi. You can organize at the McDonald's right up the street from you and go and start passing out this information and letting people know that this is a company that is involved in human trafficking and slave trade in 2015. And we're asking them to take a stand with us against that. And that's one of the, those are the two main ways that we're asking people to get involved with these movements on the outside.
Can you talk a little bit about what the relationship is between McDonald's and the prison industrial complex in the U.S.? Because I wasn't aware that there was one.
Okay, McDonald's, they use prison slave labor to make meat patties. I think they make the spoons that they use.
Right, the uniform labor also.
Okay, uniforms, yeah, the uniforms, and it's a couple of more things. They get several little pieces of their operation is they use prison labor for.
And where can people, as the time comes towards the organizing of these protests, where can people find out information that they can pass on to their loved ones and family, or be on the outside if they don't have friends and family on the inside? How can they prepare themselves?
Okay, I'm going to speak about Alabama, and then I'm going to let our other brother speak about Mississippi. On Facebook, number one, we have a Facebook group that's Free Alabama Movement, and it's all capital letters, and we keep people informed on that Facebook group. We also have a Facebook group, Free Alabama-Mississippi Movement. We keep people informed right there. We also have a website, which is www.freealabamamovement.com. And people can go on there and they can get our Twitter link, they can get our YouTube link, they can get our Facebook link, and they can get into contact with us and they can be on point. We have another Facebook group that we're creating for the McDonald's protest. We're about 75 to 80% complete with that, so we'll have that ready for the people probably in the next couple of weeks. But Facebook is our main primary organ of outreach, and then we supplement that with our radio show, The People's Platform, which they can join. We have it throughout the week, and it's always at 7 o'clock p.m. Central Standard Time. Well, it's frequently on Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays. Sometimes it's a little different, but normally those are the days that we have the show on.
Well, that's a lot. And,
like I said, the brothers are, yeah.
Well, are there any parting thoughts that you want to share with the audience? We're about at time.
I'd like to reiterate the same definition that we have developing here in Mississippi on the same websites, and that will be under the Free Mississippi Movement as well as the Free Mississippi / Free Alabama Movement. We also have a Twitter set up, you know, for the Free Mississippi Movement along with the Free Alabama Movement. And we just now establishing a United Men's and Women's, Yoko.com origin that we're actually trying to start exercising on now and capitalizing from another level of just people in general, because, you know, some people may stray away from the philosophy or the idea of mass incarceration and prison, free prison slavery. And, you know, we now just trying to unite men and women to the realization network that would really give them the sense of God and the real education to what all this really pertains and how, you know, we drawing off of this. We're hoping that, you know, that's just a start of helping people see or understand what we actually up against and what we actually are seeking in regard to public affairs and public assistance. And I said, but this is a real movement, and everything we're doing is valid and sufficient and warrants some type of relief and justification.
Well, thank you all three of you, from members of the Free Alabama Movement and the Free Mississippi Movement, from having a conversation. I really, really appreciate it, and I'll do my best to pass on this information.
All right. Thank you for having us on. We appreciate it, Bert.
Yeah. Y'all keep safe and solidarity.
For sure. Always.
Yeah, it's all the same, bro. We thank you.
I suggest getting a pen and paper out. There's currently a call out to contact the Alabama Department of Corrections and press for an end to the beatings by guards going on at St. Clair, which is in lockdown, to work to decrease the violence there and to demand an end to the reign of Warden Carter Davenport, who has overseen this increase in bloodshed. There's also a call for the removal of Warden Bobby Barrett of the Julia Tutwiler Prison for Women, which the U.S. DOJ has determined has been the site of 20 years of rape and assault and forced abortions and forced birthing by inmates at the hands of guards. Davenport also was a warden at the facility during part of this time. You may call Paula Argo, Executive Assistant to the Interim ADOC Commissioner, at 334-353-3870. That's 334-353-3870. You can tell her, or whoever answers the phone, if you want, Warden Carter Davenport and Warder Bobby Barrett to be fired. More info and a form letter can be found at prisonbooks.info in a post from January 30th, 2015. Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness.